I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us. Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. I thought we'd spend a little time today focusing on an area of the globe that we haven't focused on for a while because of all the commotion in the Ukraine and Israel and ISIL and other things that have caught the attention of mainstream media, but we've continued to cover all of these areas on our site, even though others aren't talking about them. For instance, one of the things that I noticed was that there hadn't been much talk about the coup in Thailand. Jim, what happened there in the spring?
Same thing that happened in 2006. No, Thailand is a special case in Southeast Asia. It's the one country that was never taken over by any colonial power. The Thais are very tough. I mean, they're unique in many ways. And for the last 10 years, they've been fighting a Islamic terrorist problem in their southern three provinces. About 2% of the population is Muslim, and most of them are down there in those three provinces, which were acquired from Britain in a complicated deal over a century ago. And, you know, it's got to be careful accepting gifts from the British. But anyway, the homage, right? Okay. They have been able to contain it, and basically they are slowly, as is the Thai, you know, approach to things, they're taking care of it. But in the meantime, as you pointed out, they had another coup. That's the second one in 10 years. They had another one in 2006. The reason for these coups, they've had about nine of them, I think, since they adopted a constitutional monarchy in the 1930s. See, again, the Thais are like the British in many ways, not just the gifts, but the in that they manage, you know, they work things out. For centuries, they've been an absolute monarchy, but in the 30s, they realized, this isn't really working. You know, let's have a parliament and all that stuff. Well, bit by bit, as in Britain, the parliament accumulated more power. But unlike in Britain, which only had, I believe, one military coup, the Cromwells, they've had a lot of them because the elites, shall we say, the royalists, you know, the big businessmen, the royal family, but basically the people with traditional power and money, big landholders and what have you, they have opposed democracy when it went against their interests, either actually or they thought it was going to. They don't like populism. And of course, since World War II especially, Thai politicians have found that the way to success is to be a populist. In other words, say, we're going to eliminate this problem, eliminate that problem. Now, these democratic politicians have been very successful. They basically introduced a lot of economic reforms and a lot of economic growth. The Thais are doing quite well economically. But it bothers a lot of the traditionalists who feel that, it's hard to explain. Again, it's a Thai thing, tradition. You know, you can't do this. Oh, you're corrupt. There is a lot of corruption, but it's spread around. But you've got what brought on this latest two coups was the fact that the royalists were accusing the populists, and that's a good way to describe the two sides. Basically, all these big politicians are wealthy businessmen, very successful. Again, it sounds like the Roman Republic, right? You got the patricians and the populace. They basically, the patricians accuse the populace of being too corrupt. I mean, they're not denying that they're corrupt, but they consider themselves morally superior, not just because they're patricians, but simply because they're less corrupt. So everybody's on the side of the angels. The populace are speaking for the people. The patricians are speaking for, you know, the country, the kingdom, whatever, and all that's good and circular and holy. So you get the picture. So Thailand, actually, although we've covered it in some detail since through all these coups, is not really a problem. The problem is China, which I think people get just from looking at the headlines. I mean, what's been going on in Southeast Asia since we last covered it on this show, which is probably more than a year ago, Islamic terrorism is on the outs. The Islamic terrorists have not been doing well at all in Indonesia, in the Philippines. It's bad news all around, which is good news for the rest of the world, at least. But the big problem is basically China claiming all of the South China Sea. Now, what's sad about this is China is doing this mostly for political, not economic reasons. They say, or a lot of people say, that China's are doing, they're claiming all these little rocks and reefs and what have you, and then claiming, you know, the internationally recognized economic zone, which stretches out nearly 400 kilometers in all directions. They're claiming that is because there is economic wealth, but I checked into that, and all the, you know, the surveys and what have you, the people who have looked, found that almost all the oil or any or natural gas or any real wealth is in territorial waters. In other words, China is not really going to gain much more in terms of, you know, these sort of natural resources. There isn't a huge pool of oil or natural gas, you know, sitting under these disputed waters. But what is a problem is that China is basically claiming territory which for centuries has belonged to the countries that it's right next to. In other words, China is claiming coastal waters more than 1,000 kilometers from its own coast that is like within 100 kilometers of the nearest country, which is, hey, these reefs are always ours. And what the Chinese are claiming, which is annoying right now, is fishing, control over the fishing. Now, the ironic part of that is that, you know, in the last 20, 30 years, these huge Chinese fishing fleets, as it were, or long-range Chinese fishing boats, have basically cleaned out most of the new, formerly abundant, you know, stocks of fish in the South China Sea. So basically, they're talking about going to war over a natural resource which they've already depleted, and there's nothing left. I don't know what they're going to complain about when they find out there's no there, but, you know, that's the situation. No, the essence of the Chinese claims is to basically keep the communist government in power by playing the nationalism card. That sounds familiar, right? I mean, that's the oldest game in the book and the cause of more wars than, you know, you care to think about. But basically, China is using classical Chinese, you know, tactics. I mean, if you study Chinese history, you'll see this whole routine, you know, played out again and again over thousands of years of Chinese history. They're doing it deliberately. They talk among themselves in Chinese journals. I'm talking to ones that are unclassified about, you know, not just referred to Sun Tzu, but any number of other Chinese politicians and diplomats and theorists and what have you over the centuries who have said, you do it this way, you do it slowly, you keep pushing. And, you know, when you're strong, you push. When you're weak, you offer to negotiate. You know, and so on and so forth. I mean, it sounds very cynical, but it works. And, hey, that's the way politics, successful politics, is usually carried out. The problem the countries neighboring China have right now is they have no strong backer. United States, theoretically, and in legal terms, has treaties, you know, mutual defense treaties with many of these countries neighboring China. But right now, the United States is backing off from even looking like they're going to, you know, oppose or threaten, you know, the Chinese threat. And now that may change when the current administration, you know, gets replaced, hopefully by somebody with more of a backbone. But right now, the Chinese, and they discuss this among themselves. I mean, we're not talking about state secrets here. They talk about this openly, you know, in their Communist Party and government, you know, public media. That's the only way they really form a consensus among you know, millions of Chinese Communist Party members, and, you know, and consensus is a big deal in Eastern Asia. So they want everybody, they want to know that everybody's buying into what's being done. And unfortunately, most Chinese are buying into this idea that, hey, the South China Sea, it's not named that for nothing. It really belongs to us. Actually, it's a practical matter. Based upon the historical evidence, it never belonged to China. Chinese are really, you know, they're making things up so fast, you know, it's hard to keep track. But any all serious scholars, including some Chinese ones who don't speak openly too much about this, acknowledge that, you know, there is no there is no Chinese case to be made for historical rights to this. So that right now is the big problem. Korea is stumbling along as it always has. Japan is rearming, which is ominous. For example, the Chinese in their public discussions are now talking openly about war with Japan is inevitable. How do you like that? Now, think that a little lost in the translation. For years, they were talking about war with the United States is inevitable, but it's not. That is not inevitable anymore because they realize the United States is not going right now is not going to stand up and confront China. I mean, there are confrontations going on, but nothing serious. We apologize if, you know, we do something that offends the Chinese, and the Chinese take advantage of that. But you're getting a situation, you're developing a situation, which in the past, like I think 100 years ago, 1914, World War I, where the country in 1914, it was Germany looking for a place in the sun. Well, now you have China looking for a place in the sun. Hey, we deserve it. We're the big dog. We need something. And all you need is enough mistakes, military and political and diplomatic, being made in a short period of time, and boom, you got a war. Not necessarily a nuclear war, because the Chinese are, thank God, above all, practical. And if critical assets are threatened, you'll see some rapid changes in policy. But it could get very messy and very expensive in terms of money and lives in the short run if this whole thing spirals out of control. People are playing with fire, and the Chinese have a lot of fire, a lot of stuff that can go boom. And that is something to worry about, and people should worry about it more.
Austin, your perspective?
Well, I want to comment on a couple of things Jim said. Let me first pick up on the Chinese talk of war with Japan. There's some commentary. Actually, there's a on-point column of mine, and I just found the date, Dan, looking it up. It's September 25th, 2012, so it's up on the site, my Creator Syndicate column, but archived on Strategy Page, so you can go look at it. It's called China and Japan Talk War, and that was the week I saw up on Drudge, and it was used a Drudge headline for the column, Chinese General Prepare for Combat with Japan. The Chinese pull this out on a regular basis, particularly for domestic consumption, Dan. And in this case, it was related to their struggle over the islands the Japanese call the Senkakus. And Jim, I think it's Diaoyu. I've heard the Chinese pronunciation of it several times, but I...
It's best to call it the Senkakus, because that annoys the Chinese, and right now that's the only thing we're doing.
Well,
just to annoy them a little bit.
But what was interesting to me, being that, you know, as everybody who reads Strategy Page or ever was familiar with the Strategy and Tactics magazine when Jim started it and ran it, you know, we're commentators and game designers, but we're historians first. And there this was on the Drudge headline, as I recall, did I put it in? Yeah, September 19th was a Drudge headline. Well, September 19th, 1931, as my last paragraph in the column says, on that day, the morning after what became known as the Mukden Railroad incident, Japanese soldiers attacked the Chinese garrison at Mukden in Shenyang, and then invaded Manchuria. You can make a case that Japan's Mukden aggression was the first bloodletting in what we now call World War II. A lot of Chinese think so. So when it says war with Japan is inevitable, that's the root the historical root, the grievance that the Chinese leaders utilize. And yeah, it's back. I saw that same headline, war with Japan inevitable. But look, you know, that's 2 years ago, and today's September 18th, right? We're coming up close to September 19th again. For all I know, it's already September 19th in China. Is it, Jim? There they are.
Yes.
You know, hitting the anniversary on the nose. Just to add a couple of other things on this. I thought maybe you heard me laughing when Jim says beware of something given to you by the British. Really, the ties are Buddhists. They've been battling Muslim Malay sultanates for several centuries, and not all of the southern provinces were part of the Sultanate of Patani. You will see Malays and primary Malay Muslims just to refresh it, because when we've written about this subject before in either on Strategy Page or Quick and Dirty Guide to War and the like, you learn some of these little interesting but useful historical geographic points. It's sometimes referred to as the Lost Sultanate, the Sultanate of Patani, because in the late 18th century, the Thais attacked it. And I think the date, I mean, you could go look on the web on this. It's in the 1790s when they actually take control, the Thais do, on their own, of the Sultanate of Patani. And it's roughly half of the what are now their four southern provinces where the insurgency is most virulent, which is what Jim has been covering for Strategy Page. And what happens is basically the Brits and the Dutch in the 1820s, and when they quote-unquote divide, you know, Southeast Asia, and the Brits lets some sultanates remain. Sultanate of Brunei, for example, still exists. They were essentially British protectorates, and the Dutch had the Dutch East Indies, which is essentially Greater Indonesia. A few scattered through there, the Portuguese too. But the Thais were allowed, as Jim said, they were never occupied by a colonial power. They have been their own, like Ethiopia. They're like Ethiopians in some ways. They are tough, and they ran their own business. And basically, the Brits and the Dutch said, okay, you got it, and formally absorbed in 1902. I just looked it up. That's when the Thais said, hey, we're taking this area. And the Brits and primarily Brits and Dutch said, hey, no argument. You've got it. We can deal with you. And that's the background to the area. What led them in there was the Malays claim Thai expansion. The Thais claim threat from Muslim raiders and need to control the border area and the like. And it's for the Thais part, I know this comes up infrequently, but the Thais make the accusation frequently that the insurgency is tied to the Aceh, the Sumatran Islamist separatist group in Indonesia, or that it has ties to various radical Moro Muslim insurgents in the Philippines. And the Thais, and as Jim's gone through all the political and economic corruption components of it and elements, but part of it is that they say that they're fighting an Islamist uprising. They also look and say, if you all are concerned about Singapore as being a strategic choke point, take a look at the Kra Peninsula. This barely separates the Indian Ocean from the Pacific Ocean, and that could serve as another transit point. And for what it's worth, the Thais are still looking for somebody who wants to dig a canal across it so they could compete with Singapore. I don't know. Do everybody understand what I just said? They would then build a kind of a super Panama Canal from the Pacific Ocean to the Indian Ocean across the Kra Peninsula, which is that narrow neck from the rest of Thailand, actually going down to the southern provinces that that we're discussing. So there's a lot of history behind this insurgency. And it doesn't even start in 1790. Dan, roots of it are the border troubles that existed between the Kingdom of Thailand and the Sultanate. So that didn't help too much on it, does it? It doesn't look like it's going to be solved, does it? So
no, Jim. What about the Muslim issue in those countries? At least, let's say, radical Islam in Malaysia, East Timor, Thailand, Indonesia, they've had their own issues. Are any of those becoming active over with ISIL? Are any of those groups funneling people there? Are they having, I think the Indonesia government tapped down on it pretty good, but is it still possible that they'll have their own flare-ups again?
Worldwide, there have been some people in every area, including the United States, who are entranced by ISIL. Hey, a license to kill, to loot, you know, maybe sex. And so everybody's been sending, you know, people, their local lunatics, you know, to Syria. Now, ISIL, so far, has not made a big deal about people staying where you are. Now, that is apparently changing. Until recently, ISIL didn't really encourage, you know, people to go nuts in their own hometowns. But in Australia, they just had a series of raids and arrests. They arrested, I think, over 15 people for basically plotting, again, at the behest of ISIL propaganda, to randomly grab people off the street and then photograph them being beheaded, video them. And the Australians mentioned that this, but now almost all the people arrested are people who were taken in as refugees from Muslim countries, which annoys, you know, these host countries no end, because you have the same sort of thing happening in Europe, in the United States, etc. But that's the way it goes, because the basic problem with the Muslims is that there has been for over 1,000 years, I'm more Muslim than thou attitude. In other words, if you wanted to gain some political traction, gain some power, whatever, just basically start denouncing the powers that be or your neighbors as not being Islamic enough, and then maybe kill some of them to really get things started. I mean, this sounds insane, but it happens again and again and again. In Southeast Asia, there's a unique situation, in that it was one of the last parts of the world to basically convert to Islam. And when that was done, a lot of, as happened with many, you know, religions like Catholicism, you know, in the 60s, after Columbus discovered the Americas, the missionaries came over and what have you. And when that was done, they basically accepted a lot of local religious customs. They said, oh, well, this is really this form of Islam. They reflagged it, you know, like Catholics with their saints. You go down to South America and you'll find people who know very well which of the ancient pagan gods each of these saints, you know, represents. And they worship accordingly. Now, in Indonesia, this was never an issue until Islamic radicalism became popular and some of the locals decided, hey, I'm more Islamic than thou. And they began to denounce this. Now, that, in a lot of Muslim countries, I mean, Saudi Arabia, for example, still beheads people. They did it quite recently for sorcery. In other words, for practicing ancient, you know, customs that can be denounced as not being Islamic, as being, you know, pagan. But in Indonesia and in almost all the other, actually in all the other Southeast Asian countries with Muslim populations, that does not fly. The people push back. And they say, hey, look, I can see, all right, shut down the bars, they're a bad influence, you know, cut down on the, you know, the premarital sex, all right, you know, we go along with that. Make the women, you know, cover up, you know, the older folks say, yeah, that's a good idea, but the younger folks say, screw that. But the net result has been a lot of pushback. Not only a lot of pushback, but a lot of, you know, phone calls to the police in the middle of the night. And this became especially effective when cell phones spread throughout the area in the last 2 decades. And all of a sudden, the Islamic militants found it was dangerous to be an Islamic militant. You know, if somebody dropped the dime, well, that phrase doesn't really mean anything anymore. If somebody just picks up their cell and phones the local cop they know, say, hey, you know, this, he's planning on doing this. He was mouthing off at the mosque or whatever, what have you. And next you know, they're arrested. So that's why these guys don't get traction. Now, a decade ago, when they did kill some people, especially tourists, who are a big part of the local economy, foreign tourists, this really ticked off the locals. Because they say, hey, it's one thing to yell at me for my religious practices, but hit me in the pocketbook and you get yourself a real fight. I mean, it was as practical and as basic as that. So the net result is the Islamic radicals have a very difficult time gaining any traction. I mean, ISIL is still recruiting people, you know, in Saudi Arabia. In fact, so far this month, there have been two successful prosecutions of over 50 Islamic, you know, terrorism suspects. Some of them, most of them were just, you know, attempting. But there was at least one death sentence. You know, that was just yesterday, I think. And there was one American who was sentenced to 17 years. Now, they have a special counterterrorism court established in 2008, and they don't have to release a lot of information. So people are still scrambling to find out, well, which American Muslim have we lost in Saudi Arabia lately, you know, to find out, you know, who the hell this guy is who's going away for 17 years. So the Saudis basically are reaping what they've sown. But in distant, you know, Islamic populations, you get a lot more pushback. And so they haven't really been able to gain any traction. If any of the local wackos who want to be more Islamic than now, they have to go to Syria or, you know, Yemen or any other place where there's an active, you know, Islamic, you know, terrorism campaign and get killed there. Because, you know, they can't even get anybody to, hey, guy, join with me to do this and do that. They can't even get any of their local buddies, you know, to buy in their hometown. So that's the good news. I mean, the bad news is, yes, there is some Islamic terrorism, but not enough to really, you know, make it onto the front page, because there's a lot more ugly stuff going on in the home of Islam, namely, you know, Arabia and adjacent countries.
Now, is there any, Austin, are there any conflicts going on between Malaysia and Indonesia, since they, you know, are so close to each other?
A good question. There are nascent, quote unquote, conflicts. Let's start with Indonesia itself. Throughout Indonesia, they still have it's moribund right now, but it could rise again, a Moluccan insurgency, because the Moluccans are Christians. A lot of them served in the old Dutch colonial army. They would just as soon be separated from Indonesia. I'll work my way west here with this, Dan. Even though I'm starting with the Moluccas, I'll leap back to Irian Jaya, which used to be Dutch New Guinea. That was the attack 1962, I think, is when the Indonesians invaded it. Really Javanese, because right now the Indonesia is something of a Javanese empire. At least that's the way the people on the island of Flores and some of the other older Portuguese islands see it. They also invaded East Timor. They controlled part of Timor that had been Dutch, but the East Timor had been a Portuguese colony, and they took that. Well, East Timor was had its own successful counterinsurgency. So it's now a free country, more or less protected by an Australian peacekeeping contingent. I think it's still there, but there's an Australian quote-unquote security presence, and the Indonesian government doesn't want to mess with it anymore. They lost a lot politically, diplomatically, and it's certainly didn't gain much out of their control of East Timor. But there is ongoing dislike for the Javanese on numerous of the islands. I said Flores, and you can tell by the name of the island, Flores, is that it had a Portuguese connection at one time. On Borneo and Kalimantan, the locals, tribes, feel exploited by Jakarta, and guess what they are? But that's pretty much under the control of Jakarta, the capital, and the forces, because they've got the resources on Borneo. There are a few maritime, quote-unquote, small-scale arguments. I really won't call them disputes because they're largely settled. There were two islands that are really on the Indonesian side of the Strait of Malacca that Malaysia could have kind of sort of made a claim to, but they're in Indonesia. The thing is that after Malaysia and Singapore separated, they probably should have gone to Singapore. So, but you know, it's not a big deal there. But there's you know, those the bigger issue, and I said I was going to work my way east, is the continuing Sumatran insurgency, which has to do with ethnic divisions within Indonesia. The Sumatrans say that they're being overrun and controlled by the Javanese. They should be an own separate country. They have had ties to some of the radical Islamic groups. Some of the Sumatrans say, well, it's because we need weapons. And they would give us weapons because the Malay Muslims, with the exception of their Hambali types, their Jama'a Islamiyya, I think is a name of Al-Qaeda in Southeast Asia, they say, you know, our Islam is not Arab or Wahhab Islam, is the way I'm quoting what they say, meaning that's an extremist Sunni interpretation. There are some issues over fishing rights and maritime boundaries within the South China Sea, and we have talked about Southeast Asia because we've done a couple of, as you said earlier in the podcast, we've done a couple of talks about Chinese expansion in the South China Sea, and Jim reviewed some of that. But the Chinese action has put those smaller scale disputes between the Philippines and Vietnam, Cambodia's kind of pro China, Thailand, Malaysia, and Singapore on the back burner, because the big tiger, the big panda, I was going to say the big bear, but the big panda has united a disparate group, uniting a disparate group of nations to oppose Beijing's expansionism. So there are, you know, I'm trying to think of the other, this is something I wrote about 25 years ago, Dan. There's another spot in the South China Sea, the contested shoals between Malaysia and Philippines. I'm sorry, and the Philippines off of the northeast coast. But it's moribund. They've got a bigger problem with China.
Jim, just to sort of wrap it all up, it sounds like the major issue in Southeast Asia is China and the South China Sea, and that's the thing that we ought to keep our eye on. Is this correct?
Yes. I mean, all these other things like awesome is just describing, these are basically minor beefs.
Yeah.
Nobody's ever threatened to go to big war over it. I mean, for example, there was recently, in the last few years, there was a border dispute between Cambodia and Thailand. And this is an ancient dispute, goes back a couple of centuries, over who owns what in a temple complex on the border. Big tourist attraction, right? And, of course, the Thais won because they have a bigger army and they're rougher and tougher, et cetera, et cetera. But the Cambodians, you know, it was a matter of pride, et cetera. But they eventually talked it out. I mean, there was no big, you know, there were troops sent to the border. They glowered at each other, a few shots fired. There were very few casualties. And that's the kind of conflicts you have there. I mean, you have the same thing between Burma and India and Bangladesh. Nothing to get really worked up about, but they are issues. China, on the other hand, is a major power. They're sending warships, warplanes. They're basically telling people that you have to check with us before you fish here, before you send a ship through here. These are major shipping lines, major fishing areas for a lot of the local countries that China is now claiming to own coastal areas of. So it's a big issue, and the Chinese have told the United States to butt out, that, you know, hey, you can't mess with us. And this, again, as Austin points out, appeals mainly to a domestic audience. They're saying that for the benefit of the Chinese people, who basically had 200 years of bad luck. I mean, you know, things just were not, from the late 1700s on, it was one disaster after another. And Chinese remember this. And now times are good. People are more prosperous. You know, things are looking up, et cetera, et cetera. And but unfortunately, China is still run by a communist dictatorship. There's no other way to put it. And unelected and increasingly unpopular because of the corruption, a certain amount of incompetence. And so how does an unpopular dictatorship stay in power? Create a foreign enemy. I mean, this is one of the oldest tricks in the book, and it still works. But unfortunately, it also tends to backfire. And that's what we're faced with. A volatile situation, which is likely to go very bad. And that is bad news for everyone concerned.
Dan, let me make one quick comment on what Jim said. What I talked about, for the most part, are these minor state-to-state disputes. No, they're not war makers. The war in East Timor was dirty. The Sumatran insurgency has dirty aspects. I mean, dirty little insurgencies, and of course the various Islamic insurgencies in Mindanao, Zamboanga, I'm forgetting the name of the island, Jolo Island, that in the southwestern Philippines. Ugly stuff, but the big story, you know, we follow those because they are, you know, they are for real. But the big story is Chinese expansionism and Chinese muscular nationalism, and it's. Where's that going to go? The Crimean annexation by Russia. Really, the Filipinos and Vietnamese looked at that big, the way that Putin ran right over the Budapest Accord of 1994 and then just took Crimea. And that doesn't get a lot of mainstream media coverage. It doesn't strategy page. Here I am patting us, but the thing is, it ought to be covered. So there's some places in the mainstream media mentioned it, and you know, there are plenty of people out there that understand it. But that really had you broke a diplomatic pact, a framework to try to resolve these kind of territorial disputes. And it was simply power that, you know, we're exercising power. Okay. I looking at this nascent alliance in Southeast Asia, and I'm saying, you can't. China, do you really want to get the Filipinos, the Thais, the Malaysians, and the Vietnamese, especially when they're backed up by the South Koreans and Japanese? And the Japan of 2014 is not the Japan of 1931. Tough call in Beijing, and maybe that's where we ought to leave it.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you both next time.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Till next time. Bye-bye.